ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
It's one of the largest and most complex organs in the human body. With billions of nerves and trillions of connections, the human brain is indeed a real marvel. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to talk about the science of our brains, and more specifically, the amazing circuitry that gives us our precious memories. In the studio with us today, two UWM neuroscientists who have each received major grants from the National Institute of Health to study brain function. Fred Helmstetter is a distinguished professor of psychology, and Karen Frick, also a professor of psychology in UWM's College of Letters and Science, and we welcome them to today's program. Good to have both of you with us. Fred, let's start with you. It truly is the most, I think, remarkable, amazing thing we carry around with us, our brain, and yet we really don't know that much about it, given how important it is for us to function every day.
Well, there's always more to learn, that's for sure, but it's an incredibly complicated thing. I think probably the thing to lead off with is how underappreciated the importance of it is. We take for granted things that we can do in day-to-day life and the fact that we can have this conversation, but in reality, your brain's doing all that. And I like to tell my undergrads to kind of sit back and reflect a little bit. We can read the words on the page, we can hear music playing on the radio, but there's actually a mechanistic process through which that happens, and that's what your brain does for you.
And no pause, no processing signal. It happens instantly, which is even more amazing to me.
Sure. I mean, our whole awareness of what's around us is a function of the processes happening in the brain. So,
Karen, you're also deeply immersed in the study of the brain. How did you get interested in this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I got interested as an undergraduate. I took Introduction to Psychology. Every intro psych class has a section on how the brain works. And I just thought it was fascinating. I just thought, it's kind of amazing that we don't know that much about how this organ works. It spurred me to want to start to delve into it and understand exactly how things like our memories, which make us all who we are, everyone has a unique set of memories, is stored in the brain.
You know, the other night I was together, my wife and I got together with some old friends, people we've known for 35 years, worked with them years ago, and our lives have gone in different directions, many, many different life experiences in these last few decades. And on the way home from their lake home, I was telling my wife, isn't it remarkable that over all of these years, all four of us shared the same memories? Now, they were probably different. I'm sure they were different. They were colored differently. But but for all of us to be able to reach back, and I was thinking about today's program that we're taping, and I thought, you know, how very cool that we could reconnect, and it's all because of the lasting power of what was processed in that brain, which is a memory.
Sure, and that's what gets me really excited. It's just the whole idea that we can store information like that and retrieve it later, how that process works. So that I think is pretty neat.
So give us a primer. What's happening inside the brain that allows for me to recognize you, Fred? We haven't seen each other for a little bit on campus around, but when I walked in and you were sitting there waiting near the studio, I knew that's Fred. What's up there? What's going on?
Oh, lots of stuff. And there's no real good two or three sentence answer for that. I think one way to consider the question would be to say that things are happening in a lot of different classes at a lot of different levels. So first of all, we have cells in the brain that are organized into circuits that work together and communicate with each other. And then each of those cells has an incredible rich toolbox of biochemical and genetic processes that it can use to modify things in response to experience. And that goes all the way down to individual molecules either being expressed at the surface of those cells or used as communication devices between those cells. So the answer is held at a whole bunch of different levels of analysis. So there's no one answer to that question.
And different memories are stored in different ways, aren't they? Or stored in different places.
Often, yeah. That's true. And that's one of the things that the field is very interested in. So does the quality of the information that you're retaining determine where in the brain it's stored? That's something we've wrestled with for a long time. Seems like a relatively easy question to answer, but it's turned out to be a bit more elusive than that.
It's so strange, though, to think that something as abstract as a memory, which we can't touch, we can't feel, is populating our brain because of some sort of chemical reaction.
Yeah, absolutely. As Fred said, I mean, there are billions of these chemical reactions. And as you mentioned earlier, they're happening almost instantaneously. It's a really remarkable thing that these neurons can coordinate all of these billions of biochemical reactions and in such a way that we form a fast memory. And memories, not all memories are created equal. Some of them won't last very long, like maybe what you had for lunch a week ago. Who cares? You know, you don't need to retain that for the rest of your life. But some are lifelong memories. And so they do differ in where they're stored, how they're stored, and that's one of the things we're trying to figure out.
Yeah. Think about your meeting with your friends and telling stories of something that happened 20 years ago. And again, this is something we take for granted if the brain's working correctly. When the brain stops working correctly, and we can talk about that later too, you begin to appreciate these things. But we take that for granted. What most people don't appreciate unless they sit and reflect or take a class at UWM or something similar is that that memory is a physical change in the structure of your nervous system. So just like storing it, I shouldn't say just like because it's a flawed analogy, but similar to storing information on a hard drive in a computer. There's a magnetic process that changes the structure, the surface of that media, and you can go back later and based on the changes that you made at encoding, pull the information back. There's an analogous process that happens within the circuits of your brain, and you're carrying that around. So you may not think of this conversation for 20 years. Maybe we won't see each other again for 20 years, and then I'll see you on the street. You'll say, oh, yeah, I remember back in whenever, right? He said some really crazy stuff about the brain. I don't remember what it meant, but, you know, I remember talking about it.
So where's it? Do we know where different memories are stored? And do we have any idea why one memory would be stored in one location of the brain and another memory somewhere else?
That's an excellent question. To a certain extent, we do know where some memories are stored. So there are certain parts of the brain that seem to specialize in certain kinds of memories. So for instance, the amygdala tends to be involved in emotional memories, and the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex are involved in sort of spatial and contextual memories. And we know that from decades of research, not only in animal models, but in humans, patients who have had brain damage. But as to why those brain regions developed to help form those kinds of memories, I'm not sure that we really have a good handle on that.
There are ideas about it. I mean, I think one way to think about it is, you know, the type of information or the particular significance of the information sometimes makes a difference in terms of how the networks come together and work together to store it. So, for example, always things that are important to us, and this is true for mice and it's true for people, tend to be remembered. In really broad terms, the things that are important to you are things that are going to kill you, dangerous things, sources of food, right? Things relevant to reproduction. I mean, the kind of basic stuff, right? Well, there's been a real selective advantage to organisms who can remember where the food was or remember where the predators are hanging out. So presumably that drives some of it. Ultimately, the circuits that you use to solve problems are often the same places where the memories are stored. So it's not really the case, and some people used to think this way, but I think it's less popular now. It's not really the case that there's area X in the brain is the memory area, and area Y in the brain is something else. Memory is an emergent property of how the cells interact with each other and how the circuits can modify themselves as a result of experience.
So are we born with brains that are clean slates, or do they already come loaded already with some basic memory or some basic suggestion that that if I want to live, I have to start sucking because mm-hmm. I need to get nourishment in there. Do we know? Is that learned or is that
certainly
hardwired?
That's another kind of old classic question in psychology. Mm-hmm. What's an instinct? What is a result of learning? Certainly, there are things that happen without any experience. And you can think of an infant as being a blank slate, but in reality, there's a lot that's already happened there. And only within the last, say, 20 years have we begun to appreciate the changes in the brain that can occur based on maturation before birth. Mm-hmm. And changes that can occur and differences that individual differences that can be resulting from epigenetic changes potentially in generations prior. So that's kind of a cutting edge area of research.
Right. And we've also, I think, begun to realize too that there are certain critical periods in early development in which the brain can be changed. And then after some of those critical periods, obviously there's plasticity throughout. Well, we know. I say obviously, but we really didn't realize until, I don't know, the last couple of decades that we can have plasticity throughout life, even into old age. But there are certain things that can be modified more easily than others within these critical periods.
When I was taking my first biology courses, I was told that our bodies reproduce cells, amazingly well, except for the brain, mm-hmm. that you're born with only so many.
Right.
Is that still true? Do we know that to be the case?
Turns out not to be true.
And it was a very, very controversial area of research. And it's also a very hot topic now. Where a lot of people are trying to understand what the significance. So the bottom line is that there are particular areas in the brain that regenerate neurons all the time, which was never thought to be true. The thing now is to really appreciate why. Why does this structure do it and this structure not do it within the brain? And what's the functional significance of that? And colleagues of ours are now hot and heavy trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. To what degree is new diagnostic equipment making your work easier or more productive in terms of answering some of these big questions?
Right. Well, I don't know about diagnostic equipment, but certainly there have been advances in the field that have provided tools that allow us to answer questions, to manipulate individual cells, to allow us to, in an intact animal, to allow us to manipulate a certain class of cells, whether it's silencing them or activating them, that allow us to answer questions that we simply couldn't do, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
So are you using, is it the scans like MRIs or
Well, in our case, we do a little bit of MRI, but I think in our case it's more molecular tools.
Right.
So I think it's a general principle in science that when you have technological advancement, it allows you to do experiments you couldn't do before. So if your particular question involves looking at neurons, well, years ago, maybe you were able to prepare some tissue and see them under a compound microscope and know there was a neuron there. Now, we can look at the entire genome of that neuron, how it changes, a variety of molecular markers, a variety of ways to visualize processes within that cell and between cells that didn't exist before. And those are all technological advances. They were actually scientific advances at one point for people in related fields, but that comes together to be part of the toolbox for people studying, related questions at different levels. So Karen and I both take advantage of a lot of that recent technology in terms of microscopy, molecular biology.
Right. But we have colleagues in the department who are, including Fred's lab and others, who are doing scanning.
Functional MRIs.
Functional MRI.
Sure.
Exactly. And there have been, tremendous advances in those technologies in recent years that have allowed people to answer questions they simply couldn't before.
Yeah, the molecular probes tend to be a little invasive. I mean, no one would like to have transgenes introduced into their brain. A mouse doesn't mind so much, or at least they don't say much about it. But people would probably have a problem with it.
Well, and that's really one of the great challenges, isn't it? I mean, to really understand the brain, you want to be in there watching it as it's functioning, not waiting after someone passes away and relying on
autopsy. And that's huge, particularly in the human side of it. So everything that we do with laboratory animals is relevant to humans in some way. And often, particularly in the case of our group here at UWM, there are a lot of parallels in people doing experiments that complement each other with each type of subject. So we have a group, as Karen mentioned, that is very good at doing functional brain imaging, non-invasive types of procedures to measure and in some cases manipulate human brain activity. And then other groups, which would be more typical of us today, who are kind of looking at more kind of mechanistic or smaller, you know, molecule level things or cell level things that you just can't do in a human.
Right. We're going to talk about that work in just a moment because I want to do a little deeper dive in some of the ongoing research. But first, I want to remind our listeners that they're listening to UWM Today right here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. And I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Fred Helmstetter. Fred is joined by Karen Frick, both professors of psychology at our College of Letters and Science. And I began the program by saying both of you also have received significant funding from the National Institute of Health on a variety of research projects. But right now, each of you are being funded to look at memory as part of your dissection, pardon the term or the pun, about how the brain operates. Karen, let's first talk about your funded project.
Sure.
Looking at, in part, the role that hormones, more specifically a female hormone, has on the formation of memory.
Right, exactly. So we're interested in memory formation in general, but particularly in the role that hormones play in regulating learning and memory. There are many things that modulate the formation of memory, and sex steroid hormones, including estrogens, which is our focus, are one of them. And so we are interested in this question because of mainly because of aging, because as men and women get older, and women go through menopause, it that hormonal change seems to put women at a greater risk of developing things like memory decline and Alzheimer's disease in particular. And women have been taking hormone therapy for decades, but without really knowing much about how it affects the brain. So the work that we've
designed to deal with other issues in the female body.
Yes, exactly. But we do know that it affects cognitive function from work done in not only in humans, but in a lot of work done in rodents as well. So what the NIH project that we're funded to conduct is, in again, trying to understand how estradiol, which is one of the potent estrogens, how that works on a molecular level to form a memory in our case, in mice, using them as a proxy for humans.
Any findings at this point? How far along are you in that research?
We're not quite a year into it, but I have a couple of students working on projects, one of which is looking at the involvement of a specific biochemical cascade that we think is important for estradiol to regulate memory. And I have another postdoctoral fellow in the lab who's actually looking at differences between males and females. And you may not think it's interesting that you mentioned estrogens as a female hormone. In fact, they're not. Both men and women make estrogens. And it turns out that estrogens can also regulate memory formation in males as well. So she's finding that indeed, although estradiol can enhance memory in both males and females, that the biochemical events that lead to that memory enhancement seem to be different.
Any sense of other hormones also have an influence on memory?
Oh, they do for sure. So we know from some of the work we've done and others that progesterone, which is the other major ovarian hormone that women make in the ovaries, also can regulate memory formation. Androgens can as well. More so in males than in females. So,
and so the implication is that if we understand how that hormone or hormones operate, it may impact whether or not people should take them or how much of the hormone they
yes.
should take.
Yes, I mean,
it's
at
a supplement.
Sure. At a basic level, we might better understand the risk, why women are at increased risk, and then maybe we can do something about it. And so, again, by doing this basic research in both males and females, maybe we'll learn something that could be helpful for men and women as we age.
Fred, your research also focused right now, a portion of it, on memory development. And tell us about what specifically you're looking at.
Well, the project that was recently funded looks at memory stability. So I mentioned before that when you form a memory, the ability to store that results from changes in the physical structure at the connections or synapses between neurons in your brain. And there's been a lot of research over the last 25 or 30 years to kind of get to this point where we can have a fairly confident story about how that change happens when you store the memory. But what's only more recently been appreciated is that when you retrieve the memory, so when you recall that episode that happened 20 years ago, the activity that's generated by that retrieval of the memory actually destabilizes the connection and makes it able to be modified again. And this is a huge, huge conceptual advance because it's not the way we used to tend to think about things. We used to tend to think of it as just essentially like a video recorder, but it's not. It's not passive and it's not rote. It's very, very plastic and modifiable. And this accounts for a lot of interesting phenomena, how you and I can have the same experience and remember it very differently, or how information that comes to light after you have an experience can actually modify what you think happened. So our project, essentially what we do is we take a very simple memory, we identify the circuits that subserve that memory, and then we use optically sensitive ion channels. We put them into the cells using viral vectors, and then we can control the activity of the cell with laser light, turn it on or turn it off. And by manipulating that, we can mimic what happens when you normally retrieve a memory and then look at the biochemistry at the synapse of that cell to try to figure out how those changes occur. And I won't bore you with all the kind of details of how that works mechanistically, but that's kind of where we're at.
That's really interesting because some people have some really bad memories that they perhaps would like to change.
And that's one of the really exciting potential therapeutic avenues, although I think we're well away from something like that. But when this process was originally identified in the early 2000s, this whole memory instability after retrieval, one of the first things people said was, wow, you know, can I just press a button and erase the memory of, you know, somebody I don't want to remember or something that happened to me.
And could the embarrassment go with it too?
Exactly. Exactly. So I certainly wouldn't try to sell anyone a therapeutic intervention based on where we're at with this technology right now. But that's certainly on the larger conceptual level something that might be very useful in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Karen, as you hear Fred describe his work, is there overlap? I mean, do these studies of how memory occurs or maybe doesn't occur, do the two of you talk and do you, you know, compare these different pathways to unlocking the secrets of how and why we remember?
Absolutely. So, you know, as Fred said, we're both interested in learning how memories are formed. So we do talk quite often because we're interested in similar brain regions. We use very similar approaches, methodological approaches. And in fact, Fred's started to look at sex differences as well. So we have a student who's defending his PhD in a couple of weeks who, you know, we've had numerous discussions about how sex steroid hormones may be affecting the behaviors, the fear memory behaviors that they're examining.
Where do you think we are in the history of understanding the brain? Are we prehistoric ages? Are we making rapid discoveries? Will we figure out how that great, great organ on top of our shoulders functions in the near future?
I think it would be very arrogant for me to try to place it on a timeline. I can tell you that we know a lot more about the brain, an awful lot more about the brain now than we did even when I was in graduate school, although I'm embarrassed to admit how long ago that actually was. But there is so much more to learn. And I have never, ever, and one of the things I love about my job is I have never been bored. I have never been satisfied that I really understand how this thing works. There's so much more that we can learn. So will we ever eventually figure it all out? I don't know. At some point, we may figure enough out to make the world work better. But I think there'll always be more questions.
One of the reasons we do this program is to celebrate the fact that UWM is a top-tier research university. And I suspect the fact that we have people like you and an institution that supports this research has to be very gratifying on a personal level to see the progress that we've made right here in Milwaukee answering some of these questions.
I'd say so. And I've been here a bit longer than Karen. I think I started in 1990. So seems like not that long ago, but that was a while. And things were very different then. And I've been so pleased with the way in certain particular pockets of excellence that we have in research. I don't know that across the board we're great at everything, but we're great at several things. And I think our group, largely in the psychology department, is one of those pockets. We've been able to recruit some outstanding people, including Karen, who's a leader in that group. That have complementary interests and use complementary techniques and are very successful working together and have been quite good in terms of attracting external funding and really doing good science. So that makes me really happy.
Right. And, you know, and I've only been here for 7 years, but it's been a wonderful experience in terms of interacting with my colleagues. It's really – it's a very integrative group that collaborates, that – talks as students interacting and collaborating. So it's been, you know, just a wonderful experience to have that here. And in fact, the opportunities that we can provide for our graduate students, but more importantly, our undergraduates, is really spectacular to be able to get them into research labs and expose them to the kind of work that we're doing. In fact, just before coming here, I was at a lunch for the UR at UWM students who are incoming freshmen who do research for 3 to 4 weeks in the summer before their freshman year and, you know, get a foot in the door in terms of research. And that's a program that I've been associated with for several years, and really it's rewarding for us. It's rewarding for the students. And so, you know, I'm very proud of the kinds of opportunities that we can give our students and the research support that UWM provides to them to be able to do that work.
It's all part of what makes a research university so important to the entire community because of the people that you serve. Well, we could continue to this conversation because I have so many questions, and I can actually remember a few of them, which is important since we're talking about memory. But we're going to have to save that for our next get-together because we, unfortunately, are out of time. But we want to thank both of you for joining us today, and we invite you back as you continue to do your research. We'd love to have you back and tell us more about the discoveries that come in the work that, again, being funded in this case by the National Institute of Health.
Well, thanks, Tom. We appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, thank you.
Fred Helmstetter and Karen Frick, both professors of psychology at UWM's College of Letters and Science, are guests on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.